for some of the new members, I typically put out an administrator's report for things that maybe didn't make the agenda or sort of follow-up items. There'll actually be a bit of a walk-on today related to some of the discussion around the public meeting and some of the comments and some other matters. I will provide a basic update and then obviously a more in-depth report downstream on some of those comments that were made and some of the issues. But first on my report, I did attend the Bloomberg Overdose Prevention Initiative. I won't read this to you, but we were selected. There's more than 3,000 counties in the United States. We were one of 30 selected to represent, 15 of the participants represent urban counties. The coolest thing that I can just call it is, well, for one, Tahira Malik from Samadsa was presented and was awesome, and she brought her team. They were part of a panel session called Black-led National and Local Organizing Efforts for Harm Reduction. So she was amazing, talked about all the work we're doing around harm reduction. Some of her peer specialists presented as well. And it's cool to hear how cutting edge folks in Milwaukee really are in this space, and particularly in how we allocated opioid settlement funds. I can say I was, they assigned me to the great breakout sessions that I would attend. So Bloomberg had orchestrated this very closely. I was in a number of discussions around allocation of opioid funds, particularly how to look at those allocations through an equity lens and using transparency. I later discovered the reason they put me there is because ours was completely transparent and really was focused on funding our grassroots organizations, really targeting underserved communities. For those of you who were actually a part of the process, you know, our awardees are really a very diverse group of folks in our community, a lot of grassroots agencies. Some jurisdictions, folks didn't even know the dollar amount that had been awarded to their county, state, or community. And I came with a absolutely complete annual report that said how we got there, who was allocated, what the outcome measures were. I mean, we were so far ahead of game. So it's always fun to be there. I learned, you know, really the reason they put me in the room was to sort of like point out like this isn't impossible, like you can do this. We're very strong here in the fact that we do in Milwaukee County and under the leadership of the county executive and director of the grant, you know, it's equity first, it's mission first. We're trying to make the community healthier by including our community in the decisions we make and identifying where the resources need to go. And so it was, for me, it's always motivating to be at an event like this to hear that, you know, there are spaces where we're ahead of the game. We're not going to stop. We're going to continue to expand our efforts. There's some great partnerships with Vital Strategies here. Vital Strategies is a subcontractor from Bloomberg doing work in Milwaukee. Adrienne Hurst is our representative. Because of the, she's been able to catalyze some things. One follow-up from this that didn't make the report, but has happened subsequently, is there's a national effort through Johns Hopkins to review harm reduction vending machine projects. We were kind of at the cutting edge, but now there's lots of harm reduction vending machine projects nationally. And so there's a Hopkins study around basically looking at each machine as its own sort of study, because each machine is in its own little ecosystem, its own neighborhood. And so we're gonna work with them to make sure that every machine is placed in a way that meets our community needs. Our approach to harm reduction vending machines is unique in that we've included suicide prevention supplies like unlocks. And so I think we'll see an expanding partnership with Johns Hopkins, and it's nice to have their research folks allocated to us free of charge as part of a larger national effort. We will continue to be part of this overdose prevention initiative. The county exec has a leadership role in the counties association, which works really closely with Bloomberg. So it's cool stuff. We will continue to participate and provide updates as we move through the cycle. This was an annual event, and we will go back next year. My task between now and then is to find the best possible ways to talk about our successes and include some of our providers in sharing what we're doing here that's working nationally. Again, to that theme, you know, for the last 8 years, we've really tried to put ourselves in place as a national best practice leader. And in this space, we very much are a leader in getting these funds out. And, you know, we didn't allocate, you know, our funds for bulletproof vests and, you know, squad cars. And that didn't happen here. And it's because the folks in the leadership roles recognize us as a great opportunity to serve a very substantial challenge in our community and serve it equitably and effectively. So there's a second item on our VH's future state space. Space has been a challenge for us, as you all know. In the development of the new DHHS building right across the street, which for those of you who haven't been here in a month or two, is going up fast. It's amazing how quickly it happens. But there were a couple of programs in our organization, our crisis mobile, our transport team, and our ACT team, that we intended to contract for space in a community health center. Those lease negotiations it didn't work out for us. There were some challenges around renovations. There were challenges around parking. One of the challenges our crisis service and our ACT team are growing services that for 3 or 4 years ago when we started these discussions, we didn't anticipate growing as fast and successfully. We do have a long-term plan for those services to be housed in this building after what is expected to be a very substantial renovation. But we need interim space. So Amy Lorenz and the team are working very closely with the county facilities group are looking for temporary spaces for those staff. It has to accommodate about 50 vehicles because you have the staff vehicles plus the crisis mobile vehicles. There has to be room for the park squads to park. In the long run, we believe that the space remodeling in the first floor of this building will be perfect. It'll be adjacent to DHS, which is amazing with all the no-on-door opportunities there around benefits assistance and other programs. The Mental Health Emergency Center will be about a block away. Our housing division isn't that far away, so we believe that eventually being co-located here is a solid central location with easy deployment to the community. But there will be a challenge in finding a short-term space. There will be some expenses associated with that, although I believe those all have been budgeted. But just wanted to give you the update that we're not all going to fit in the new building because this was not in the plan to begin with. But the synergies of the Crisis Mobile, ACT AOT, and Transport Team make a lot of sense as far as our service delivery. It also means there's a lot of cross-pollination that might occur with our teams and the work that we might do as we respond to community crisis as a person-centered way as possible. So, and then finally, Social Development Commission, just wanted to make it clear to the board, there was a SDC award for the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant. They were awarded $364,619 for 2024. We learned that there were challenges as SEC, and we literally found about it in the paper. Although the county, we did receive some outreach from county resources around contracts and clarifications. So it's on the record here for you. We were only invoiced about $31,396 for the work between January and March. My team did have regular communication with the prevention resources at SDC, literally up until the last week they were open. So there's no question or concern that they weren't operating in the prevention space consistent with their contract. But that leaves a pretty substantial amount of funds that need to be allocated. As we sort of alleged, referenced earlier, we will be issuing a new RFP. It was the only way we really felt it was appropriate in this situation, this would be an opportunity for any interested prevention organization or organizations to seek this money, which is just about $332,000. So that RFP will be let shortly. And there are three other provider agencies delivering prevention services. So it's not like there are zero community prevention services being provided. You just have to find a provider or providers to allocate this unspent fund for 2024. So that's the path moving forward. So any questions on those three items? And then I have one additional item that's essentially a lockdown.
I just want to congratulate you on the other work at that conference. Thanks for being a leader, national leader, your team, but that's incredible. And thanks for sharing it. I know you're a humble person, so really appreciate hearing about it. And I think it needs to be something that we raise up and share with the community. So great work. Congratulations. Thank you.
So a final item, and this is sort of has been alluded to in other items earlier in the meeting. So I did meet with Chairwoman Neubauer and Kathy Bottini recently to review. At the previous meeting, there was a discussion around a closed session. Essentially, it came down to a noticing issue, and there was a unfortunate miscommunication and I don't believe that there was full understanding of the item. So in a nutshell, in order to go into closed session, we have to notice the item in a way that any person in the community would know what that item is. You still can keep things sort of private. An example would be you're going to have a conversation of an employee disciplinary matter. You would notice that we're going into closed session to discuss a disciplinary matter, but you wouldn't list the person's name in the public disclosure or something like that. In this situation, there were people that had come intending to speak, but it is not allowable to have public testimony in these closed sessions as well. So there was a discussion. We ended up very briefly going into closed session without actually discussing the item that was raised, came out of closed session, and then the follow-up was to go over some information about that particular situation. But also, in light of the public comment session, there were some comments made that also warranted some little follow-up. So in the first item, the item from the previous meeting, I was able to get some supporting documentation around some concerns that were raised about an unfortunate outcome, a tragic outcome for a community member. Essentially, the item was related to services provided to the housing division. There were questions about whether that individual was concurrently enrolled in services funded by the mental health board. At the end of the day, there is pretty clear documentation that there's no evidence of any abuse or neglect or improper care. It really came down to a terrible outcome that people were concerned about. I was able to provide some pretty clear documentation from the medical examiner's office. It was reviewed. I think there may have been some sense in the community that, I'm trying to balance how I say this, but some misinformation had sort of just grown about the situation that was pretty clear. There's pretty clear documentation that there wasn't any sort of abuse, neglect, challenge. Obviously, there's always room for growth and any sort of feedback. And in the documentation, we were able to provide that the parties involved, the agencies involved, had made steps to address a concern moving forward, and there was some effort. On the public comment section, there was a story quoted from the December, it was Fox 6 online, and there was a couple other places where there had been a statement by the West Dallas Police Department about an individual with mental health issues who the story implied that he was the perpetrator of a murder and a murder-suicide, when actually the subsequent documentation post December 5th actually, he was the victim of a murder-suicide, and the perpetrator of the homicide was a relative. The story that ran in the paper also implicated very clearly that the Mental Health Emergency Center had violated some protocols. This all was very well investigated, and I did have active discussions with some of the parties involved, but there was never a retraction. So subsequently, it was clear that the story in the paper was not accurate. The Mental Health Emergency Center, when an individual presents at the Mental Health Emergency Center, the physicians there that are credentialed by the Behavioral Health Services Division are charged with completing a treatment directive supplement. A treatment directive supplement is a statutorily required assessment by a physician, and we credential the physicians at MHEC. The agreement there says that at least one physician at all times in the house shall be a credentialed as a treatment director designee for Milwaukee County. Under the law, that the physician must assess an individual who is brought to MHEC involuntarily, and they basically assess whether the person has a mental illness, whether that illness is treatable, and that individual is imminently a danger to themselves or others. If they can't sign that form, they can't hold an individual being detained. And so the reference to the Mental Health Emergency Center in the story, I believe, did not understand the fact that just because someone is brought to MHEC doesn't mean that they automatically become admitted. They still have to meet criteria. I think it was also alleged that there was some collaboration around, again, it's all in public domain, so you can see the article. It talked about a criminal charge and a criminal conversion. In the event of one of those criminal conversions, which I actually mentioned earlier, the only way to convert a criminal case to a civil case is if the actions that the individual took that they were charged for would have to meet the criteria of the threshold for dangerousness under the Chapter 51 statute. The threshold to arrest someone is very low. The threshold to take someone into custody under emergency detention is very high, as we all know. And so there are some cases where the attempt to convert a case is sought, everybody involved recognizes that the person has a serious mental illness. They've literally just been assessed sometimes for months and treated at the state hospital when, if they are declared not competent, not likely to regain, in order for them to successfully convert that case to a civil commitment, it still has to go through that dangerousness process that essentially becomes very much like a new emergency detention. And so in cases like that, which I believe was what this newspaper article was getting at, there was a belief that just because there was this hold or there was some sort of civil action with that would have led to essentially a long-term hospitalization. And again, this is an example of, as Dr. Lehrman mentioned, there just are some misunderstandings about how the system works. I have actually reached out to the city of West Dallas. I've sought a retraction. This is a case that really is a stigma situation where, you know, the community just assumes because there's a negative story involving a person with mental illness that they must be the perpetrator of a crime. And so I tried to get it clarified on the record. My sense is this was an old article and I think 6 months had passed. But somebody read this article aloud as an example of our, quote, failed mental health system. And I think it painted a completely inappropriate picture. I did share with that advocate, you know, this story. This isn't a great example. I understand what you're trying to do, but this scenario has been sort of proven to be incorrect. Furthermore, there were a couple of comments, and this is where I'll have to provide a more detailed response at a later meeting, but for instance, one of the speakers alleged about 80% of the people discharged from the mental health emergency center are discharged home. That's their status. There's only so many choices in our discharge documents. One of the folks in the meeting basically stated that, well, all 80% of those people of us are discharged from the street and homeless. That is not even remotely true. In fact, we don't discharge anyone to the street who is under our care for emergency detention. Furthermore, there was an allegation that the underspend in our CSP program was because all of our clients are in jail. I believe is how it was presented. Really, the underspend in the CSP program is around workforce issues, that these providers aren't fully staffed, so they're not billing to our projected numbers because they don't have the staff to bill. It really doesn't reflect the change in the provider, the customer population. It's more of an impact of the staffing, where they're just not able to generate any bills. I do take notes at those meetings. I do actually have the comment cards. We always follow up with folks. In this previous meeting, some of the folks that spoke, I actually had spoken to prior to the meeting that they came and made their comments, which is totally appropriate. Some actually referenced speaking with me, which I appreciated. Finally, there was one speaker who expressed some concern around a discharge at Granite Hills, and I actually, in response to that, I'm working really closely with Dr. Sanders, and I will present, either have her present at Quality, or I will present at the next board meeting in my administrator's report, just going over some general numbers around their discharges, because again, there were some allegations around discharging to homelessness and the like. That is not how we operate, and we work very closely on discharge planning, particularly for individuals who are involved in services. I think a general theme from the public comments, though, were there's a group of very staunch advocates. I understand their motivation. These are folks who have a family member with a serious mental illness. It's a very challenging place to be to try to support someone, but many of their adult children are not willing to include that as part of their treatment teams, and they will not sign releases. A lot of the comments were like, well, no one told us about this plan, or we don't know what's going on, or the assumption when they aren't told something is that nothing has happened. And in almost every case I've reviewed personally, there's much more to the story than the family members are aware. And I understand that they're frustrated with this, but the treaters involved here are basically, these are rules we must follow. We need informed consent, we need a release of information to share information throughout the networks, throughout the systems. And I looked at charts that basically said, my treatment plan goal is to not have my family member involved in my care and to do this on my own. And it's like called out in their treatment plan. So there's a balance there. And we believe that the key will be continued community education around this. I think we've made it clear that some of the privacy rules and some of the limitations in Chapter 51 do not lie locally. These are state and federal regulations. But I also, in the essence of the no locked door philosophy, we're not going to use those rules as an excuse. I mean, we're going to engage as much as we can. We do seek releases in these situations so that family members might be looped in. The teams do proactively say, hey, we know your family members are really concerned. Can I share with them about housing or whatever? And so that it's not like we really are hiding behind these rules. These are just rules that exist. They exist for very good reasons, but it's not always well understood by folks who, you know, would feel much better if they knew everything that was going on with their loved ones. So that's just a general comment that's emerged in the last few meetings as a recurring theme around privacy and sort of, we really focus on our customers, the people receiving services. While we always want to help their families, the customers really drive that level of collaboration and disclosure. So that's my sort of general comment. But I will provide much more detail around specific comments, and I'll tie them back to the original comments for the request. This was all submitted before the actual meeting last week, so I wasn't able to include that.